Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, August 1st, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on what is the best approach for dealing with Putin's Russia. My name is Christian Corgan, and I'm Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts to discuss the topic. Mr. Brian H. Hook, who is the founder of Latitude LLC and former Assistant U.S. Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs. And we're also pleased to welcome Ms. Heather Hurlburt, who is the Senior Fellow in National Security at Human Rights First. More complete bios for both of our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I'll stop there and preserve more time for their presentations, and as always, followed by your questions. The way the format's going to go today, we're going to hear from Heather first and then Brian. So without any more ado, the floor is yours, Heather.
Great. Thank you so much, and thanks for having me. I should say that starting as a college student in Ukraine, going through my time in the State Department and Clinton White House, I sort of feel like my career has gone along with a string of crises over Ukraine. So it's really fun to get to talk on this topic. So just first, a quick history lesson. How did we get here? Ukraine has been on the fault line of the Catholic and Orthodox worlds, let's say, the two different parts of Europe for hundreds of years now. Parts of it belonged, as people will probably know, to the Habsburg Empire, to the Imperial Russian Empire, went back and forth. And most recently, it was a Ukrainian referendum in 1991 that really delivered one of the death blows to the Soviet Union. That having been said, Ukraine is nonetheless a split society, deeply connected to Russia economically, culturally, politically, militarily. So in recent years, you had the Orange Revolution, which deeply concerned Moscow as it suggested that Kiev could get out from under its orbit. But Moscow found itself able to reassert control or influence through a combination of financial and political pressure after the Orange Revolution, chief among them, of course, that Ukraine is almost totally dependent on Russia for energy supplies. So with that as a backdrop, and it's also, I should say, been clear for years that Moscow's red line was that Ukraine not be permitted to join Western European institutions such as NATO or the European Union. And it should be said that Ukrainians themselves have been sharply divided on those questions. So we come now to last fall, where the EU, in its own wisdom, had finally gotten around to offering Ukraine an association agreement. And it's clear in retrospect that the president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, come under heavy pressure from Moscow not to sign the agreement. He announced he wouldn't sign it. This sparked massive demonstrations in his capital by young westernized people. These demonstrations, nonviolent, eventually started to attract extremist elements, which Ukraine has, also seemed to have attracted provocateurs. And suddenly, in the midst of Putin's showcase Olympics in Sochi, you have massive violence in the center of the capital of Ukraine. And you also have the European Union and specifically the foreign minister of Poland getting involved in mediating a settlement which removes Yanukovych, the leader who we see in retrospect seems to have been very heavily subsidized by Moscow, down to his famous gold-plated toilets and other excesses at his mansion. And it appears that what happens at this point is Putin suddenly says, this is not acceptable. This is a loss of control that's not acceptable. And some combination of Russian special forces operating without insignia on their uniforms and local militias which form in eastern Ukraine, but which interestingly seem to be organized and directed by a combination of retired Russian military and political consultants. One of the more colorful figures being a guy whose main line of business before the war in Ukraine was actually being a military reenactor, and who spent his weekends reenacting the Russian Civil War. Anyway, he's now doing the real thing near the crash site in eastern Ukraine. So that's how we get to the taking of Crimea. An interesting note for given the legal backgrounds of many on this call is that although it's really beyond dispute that Russia has played a role here that's completely outside the bounds of international law, there's nonetheless a very great interest in appearing to adhere to the forms of international law, so that there was this bogus referendum in Crimea. There was then an attempt to stage a referendum in the eastern half of Ukraine. So it's just a fascinating side note that this very autocratic and to westernized lawless regime is nonetheless very interested in the form of elections, international law, so on and so forth. So as folks know, and as Brian will get into in more detail, there's then a couple of rounds of sanctions in response coming from Washington and European capitals, with an effort to target individuals and not target the government, and the strategy having been rather than go after the really significant economic ties between Russia and Western Europe in particular, go specifically after the group of oligarchs, of wealthy businessmen around Putin, with the assumption being that they would pressure him to change course. And in fact, the opposite seems to be happening. Because in the wake of the shoot down of a Malaysian airliner over eastern Ukraine, Russia now seems to be ramping up the military assistance it's providing to the rebels. It's continuing to mass troops on Ukraine's border, and in the last week, there have been more and more credible reports of Russian forces actually shelling across the border and thus participating or giving support to the efforts of these militia groups. We still don't know to what extent there are actual Russian forces fighting with these groups, but we now do have evidence that they're actually getting concrete live fire support in addition to equipment and so on. So as I said, Brian will talk more about the sanctions piece, but I wanted to just finish up by noting sort of the range of what is being done and what could be done. So to take the military piece first, it's worth noting to start this conversation that Russia's military spending has increased by 50% in the last 5 years, and Putin has made an aggressive effort to improve the quality of the Russian military, which had a pretty justifiably bad reputation. Stalin liked to say that quantity is its own quality. And there was an assumption, dating back to World War II and before, that if you had enough troops, you could just throw them at whatever your objective was. What we've seen from the special forces operations in Crimea and elsewhere is that Russia at least has some troops that are now very excellent and that interestingly seem to be trained according to Western protocols rather than according to old Soviet protocols. In response to this, over the last 5 years, NATO spending has fallen by 20%. And very few, I believe it's three or four, of the NATO members other than the U.S. meet the guideline of spending 2% of GDP on defense every year. In the wake of the initial crisis in Crimea, there's been a lot of discussion. Interestingly, the countries that are actually ramping up defense spending are non-NATO members, but Russia's neighbors like Sweden and Finland, both of which actually have ramped up military spending and have begun internal conversations about potentially joining the alliance, while you have actual current alliance members going in the other direction. So NATO has staged new exercises in the east. The U.S. has sent 500 troops to Poland on a temporary basis. For the first time in more than a decade, nuclear-capable bombers were flown to Britain and conducted a joint exercise at the same time the president visited Poland. Last month, the U.S. at least has begun providing non-lethal aid to the Ukrainian military. There's quite a bit of debate about what kind of assistance would prove useful. The challenge on the military side is that what would probably be helpful is intelligence and training, again, to the Ukrainian military, which is trained and guided in the old Soviet fashion about how do you fight guerrilla groups and how do you fight sort of these special forces, a dilemma with which Americans are familiar from Iraq and Afghanistan. And those are things that take time, and so they're not very satisfying military responses. A couple of other options and suggestions that are out there. One of the things Putin has done very effectively is really close the information space and create a propaganda environment where Russians and Russian speakers are hearing a completely different narrative of events in which, you know, it's possible that the U.S. gave Kiev missiles that shot down the Malaysian airplane, et cetera, et cetera. So one idea which has begun to be discussed but hasn't been acted on anywhere, for obvious financial and other reasons, the former U.S. information operations in Eastern Europe have really been cut back in recent years. People may be familiar with Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, which broadcast in Russian and other languages, no longer do so, or do so in a very limited way. They're shells of what they were. So what is our information strategy to make it harder for Putin to keep his society closed? You know, at this point, one could argue that we're doing better at telling our side of the story in Iran and Cuba than we are in Russia. So that's an interesting area that hasn't been explored at all. Now, why does this matter? What is Putin trying to do here? Just as my final point. And Russia really has three foreign policy goals, which are pretty consistent across time, regime type, and which Putin has very clearly identified. And the first one really is securing the foundations of the regime, which in this case is both containing domestic unrest, preventing the emergence of an opposition, dealing with Russia's own extremist terrorist threat that it faces internally, and making sure that it can keep pumping out the oil and natural resources that are sustaining it economically. Second is reestablishing Russia's global status. Putin has said that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest tragedy of the 20th century. And he and the people around him clearly believe, and again, this is something that goes back to imperial times, that Russia has a right to be a first-tier world power, and by first-tier, they mean the U.S. Finally, and connected to both of the other two, is reestablishing dominance of the post-Soviet neighborhood. That there's a profound way that it has never seemed fully legitimate to Russian elites that these countries were gone. And that their being gone represents sort of an embarrassing moment of Russian weakness that needs to be repaired. And there is really a very widespread point of view that Russia has a legitimate interest in how these societies are run. So whatever else Putin's bottom line is, and there's a lot of sort of, I think, quite baseless speculation in the media about whether Putin's, quote, back is to the wall, unquote. But Putin has no intention of allowing Ukraine to be run by a government he can't influence. And it seems to me that is very clearly his bottom line, and that's the thing that Western decision makers will have to contend with. And I think I have now talked for more than my allotted 8 minutes. Brian, over to you.
All right. Thanks, Heather. That's a very thoughtful and helpful background. I can maybe talk a little more concretely about what U.S. and the EU have been up to this week. The downing of the Malaysian jet finally kind of forced the U.S. and Europe to impose additional sanctions on Europe. And so I can say a few words about the objective of pressure and the effectiveness of the sanctions and my take on what the U.S. and the EU are up to. I think any time that we're talking about sanctions, which occupies that middle ground between diplomacy and the use of force, you have to ask, what is the objective of the pressure? And in this case, I think the goal should be to convince Putin to withdraw Russian weapons and the rebels from the Ukraine and end support to the secessionists. And we also need to send a signal to Putin that the West, as a policy matter, believes in a Europe that is whole and free. And that is a very stark alternative to Putin's vision which is, as Heather was talking about, to dominate its neighbors. And Putin's vision of increasing authoritarianism is at home. So there are two issues there, I think, on the sanction side. There's what's going on the ground there in Ukraine, but then also Putin's larger goal, which Heather talked about. And when the United States goes down the sanctions road and starts looking at sort of different tools at its disposal, you always have to be asking, is this going to achieve our goal? My own view is that the new sanctions won't achieve this goal. You look at, what the U.S. and the EU did on Tuesday, and it's not enough. I think it's not proportionate to what we've seen Putin doing in Ukraine and then leading up to the present. The EU sanctions are, targeted, some key sectors of the Russian economy. The U.S. sanctions, focus on some banks. But when you look at it, these fall short of the type of sectoral sanctions that a lot of people, including me, think would be important and would be a more proportionate signal in terms of the Russian aggression. Even looking at there's an arms embargo, but that doesn't apply to existing agreements, which means that France, can still go ahead and sell its Mistral warships to Russia and be allowed to go forward with the deal. They don't touch the natural gas business, which is, that's a big part of the Russia's export economy. It's obviously very important to the Europeans. And you just look at the sanctions that came out this week, and I think there are a lot of loopholes in it. My experience, I spent a few years in the UN Security Council working with the Brits, the French, and the Germans, the P3 plus one, on sanctions. And the pattern that I saw time and time again is that the Europeans never want sanctions, to hurt them more than they hurt the other side. And they're just very, very concerned about their economy, and invariably they will put their economic interests ahead of addressing international threats to peace and security. The problem, I think, right now is that the rough U.S. foreign policy of leading from behind is that we are tethering our response to kind of what the Europeans are willing to do. I think the better approach when it comes to something like sanctions is for us to set the bar at what we think is necessary to be a game changer, to really sharpen the downsides for Putin's conduct and sort of aggression. Figure out what that is, and then try to bring the Europeans around to that position. And I just don't get the sense that that's what's happening in the bilateral relationship there between the U.S. and the EU. The Europeans are highly reluctant to move forward with sweeping economic sanctions. They've got enormous economic exposure to Russia. And I saw this in the case of when we were working on sanctions on Iran. The Germans have enormous economic exposure in Iran, and they're very hesitant to do anything that is going to hurt their economy. Our argument is, the United States, cut off its economic ties to Iran many, decades ago, because we think that's the responsible way for these kind of governments to behave. And the Europeans are just not where we are on these issues. And it really, I can't stress enough the importance of U.S. leadership to get the Europeans to sort of do what needs to be done when it comes to economic sanctions. I think I would say, just in sort of in closing, we are in a pattern. And I talked earlier about what is it going to take to change the game? And unfortunately, we have had a series of game changers, but it's always the same sort of pattern, and nothing seems to change. There'll be some sort of provocation by Russia. There'll be a lot of tough talk from the Obama administration. The Europeans will engage in a lot of tough talk. There'll be, calls for drawing a line in the sand and threats of further, sanctions, if there's more provocative behavior, Putin then takes that step, does something provocative, and then we start the whole process over again. I have thought that there have been enough game changers in Ukraine, sort of enough game changers that we should be past the point where we are now. And I feel like we're playing catch-up. I feel like Putin is way ahead of the West. And without U.S. leadership, I'm afraid that's going to continue to be the case.
All right. This is Christian Corgan. Heather, do you want to take a couple minutes to respond to anything that Brian said or add anything additionally?
Sure. There are two things. And one is to start by stressing just how strongly I agree with Brian about Europe being the central problem here. I mean, one of the sort of remarks I wanted to make was that I'm not sure Europe believes in Europe whole and free anymore. And I think, the Iran example is very instructive because it took multiple different kinds of approaches from multiple administrations, you know, starting with the one he served in or even before, to get to the point where in the Obama administration you did finally have U.S.-European agreement on pretty severe Iran sanctions that eventually brought Tehran to the negotiating table. Now, it distresses me to think that it might take that long to get a similar result from Russia, but I think that's a very real possibility, in part because of how important this issue is to Putin, and in part because of the Europeans' sort of debate on what their interests actually are. You know, you had the extraordinary spectacle after Crimea of Tony Blair suggesting that we shouldn't be too quick to sanction the Russians, which was a little hard for me to understand. So we need to understand that in a way that the administrations of both parties have experienced, the Europeans, and starting with our friends the Germans, who designed this whole system where Europe would be massively dependent on Russian natural gas and thought it would help keep the peace in Europe, have a very different view of the situation. Now, it is the next development that I think is going to be fascinating is that the views of European publics and European elites parting company. The fury that you have in the Netherlands over the Russian and Ukrainian separatists' response to the downing of the plane, the mistreatment of the wreckage and the corpses. And you now have actually Europeans talking about whether the investigative team needs some kind of armed protection, which frankly is a huge step from where Europe was even a month ago. So, I would frame the challenge for U.S. leadership a little differently than Brian and say that, the real challenge is going to be sort of how quickly can you guide Europe and move it without getting so far ahead of it that you can easily be dismissed by our friends in the European elites that drive Democrats and Republicans alike completely crazy over the years. I always say that nothing brings out the bipartisan in me like talking about Europe.
Brian, do you have any thing you want to add?
No, I think that's well said. I agree with everything Heather said.
Well, in a moment, we'll open the floor up to questions, if that's all right with both of our speakers. We'll now take your questions. So if you and you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. If I could, while we're waiting for questions to jump on the line, if I could take the moderator's prerogative. Brian, you had mentioned that we should be looking for, or that Europe wasn't willing to look at some of these, what you called game changers, and we should be looking for those types of things. Do you have any ideas of what those, what those might be?
What would it take to change the game in terms of for Europe to start taking this seriously? That's the thing. I really had thought that the annexation of Crimea would be enough. That turned out to not be enough, and we've since had a series of incidents since then. And the Western response is still very tepid. And I'm really at a point where I'm asking myself, how many game changers does it take to change the game? And I'm baffled by it. I'm baffled that there's been sort of the U.S. response has been insufficient. The European response has been insufficient. I think it is obviously a complicated situation for the reasons that Heather talked about. But I think we've got to be showing more leadership. You would have to have, you know, Putin, even after the downing of the jet, instead of de-escalating, escalated. And Putin's a very canny and very thoughtful and smart and strategic guy. And I think he's going to keep sort of, you know, as I think it was Lenin said, probing with bayonets and see how far he can go.
I'll jump in on that, too, actually. One thing that is happening now that is potentially a game changer, although, unfortunately, I don't think we'll see the results for a number of months, but as soon as this latest round of sanctions was announced, you had a number of European companies, including companies that aren't in the oil or military or finance sectors like Adidas, just to name one example, that announced that they were scaling back or canceling plans for operations in Russia. So it may be, and frankly, this is the pattern we saw with Iran, it may be that you start to have a decoupling of the European-Russian economic relationship. And so every time the U.S. tries to go back and get further on sanctions, it'll get easier because businesses will be you know, voting with their assets, as it were. A related game changer that's also worth mentioning is the flow of Russian assets and the use of those assets. You know, people may be familiar with the Russian oligarchs who own some prominent sports teams in Britain and elsewhere. And there's also been some talk in recent days about the role of Russian oligarchs' money in politics, in Western European politics. And to the extent that that starts to be openly discussed, I think that's a very interesting game changer, again, in the question of whether European publics revolt against the plans of European elites that created the kind of economic interdependence that we're now seeing.
All right. Well, it looks like we have two questions on the line, so we'll go ahead and go to our first question right now.
Hi, this is Jason Rowe in Houston. I want to ask two questions. I guess first, how is this going to play out with Russia or the U.S.'s recent claims that Russia has violated the nuclear treaty? And then the second question was, how likely is Asia to step in with Peter Harrell's trip over there? And Asia likely to implement any sanctions?
Yeah, those are both really good questions. The interesting thing about the announcement that from the U.S. side accusing Russia of violating the 1987 Reagan-Gorbachev Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, the specific action has been known for more than 6 months. It was briefed to Congress. There's been quiet discussion of how to resolve it. And so what the administration clearly did was pick this moment to say to the Russians, you know, we're not interested in working with you to resolve this anymore. We're now going to tell you to resolve it. We're not going to allow you to continue to pose as the champion of wanting there to be fewer nuclear weapons in the world while you're creating a new class of missiles. The other thing that I think was significant about this particular violation is intermediate-range missiles don't threaten the U.S., but they sure as heck threaten Russia's neighbors. So this is, I think, the choice to go public with this now represents a very, you know, it's a way that Washington can ratchet up the pressure without the support of the allies, and it's also a signal to the Eastern allies, you know, the Baltic states, Poland, and so on, who are more in sync with the U.S., by the way, that that we see that this development is happening. On the Asia question, you know, it's interesting. There was some large Russian entity that recently converted 40% of its holdings into Hong Kong dollars held by China. So in the short term, China is very much the beneficiary. Japan has put sanctions on Russia and got a pretty nasty response from Moscow for doing so. Japan, again, more in line with the U.S., but less helpful. The rest of Asia is, I think, unlikely to get very deeply engaged, nor, frankly, is Moscow likely to care very much.
Yeah, I saw. Japan, I saw, has moved forward on some sanctions, which are negligible at best. Asia, I'm sure, is taking its cues to some extent from what it sees in Europe. And as Heather was pointing out, if Europe, which really is the greatest stakeholder in the world right now of what's happening in Ukraine, if Europe is being tepid and inept and unserious about what's happening in Ukraine, I don't think Asia is going to take on that fight for them. And so if you were to see a more concentrated and effective response from the West, I think that you would see probably a force multiplier happening in Asia, not on the same scale, but it would still help the cause. And they're taking their cues from the West, and the West is just responding rather ineptly to this, and so I don't think there's any reason we should see a strong response from Asia.
All right. Well, this is Christian again. I think it looks like we have one more question on the line, and then our lines will be open. So if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts or both of them, press star and then the pound key, and we'll go to our one remaining caller right now.
Hi, this is Calvin Gelma in Atlanta. What I wanted to ask is, in view of the Obama administration's current leadership on this crisis in Ukraine and the European response, particularly the German, I think it's fair to say that both America and Europe want Ukraine to be a part of Europe, but neither is willing to put much on the line to make sure that that happens, particularly the Europeans and the Germans. That's clear. So in light of what Heather has said about what Putin's bottom line is, if the United States wants to see Ukraine maintain its territorial integrity and or avoid a bloody civil war developing with Russia, does the United States need to encourage Ukraine to take a more non-aligned approach than effectively go all in with Europe? Or how do you see this playing out? Because I just don't see anybody really talking about the bottom line of where Putin is going to push this to and whether Ukraine needs to adopt somewhat of a middle course to fend off further incursions and a full-scale invasion by Putin.
All right. Do either of you want to tackle that?
Heather, since he had mentioned you, do you want to take the first stab at it?
Sure. I'll start with that. I think the challenge for dealing with Ukraine that every administration has wrestled with since 1991 is that we can't change geography. So we can't cut Ukraine off and move it further away from Russia. So you're never going to have, as the caller pointed out, you're never going to get out from under the Russian interest. So successive U.S. administrations have, with greater and less focus and greater and less success at different times, tried to help successive Ukrainian governments with greater and lesser degrees of competence think about how to situate itself in a position that makes it clear to Russia that it's not going to do anything hostile to Russia, that it's not going to, Ukraine's not going to house an invading force, that it's not going to seek to undermine Russia, but that it at the same time has the right to select what kind of economic system it wants, who its trading partners are, who its interlocutors and models are. And, frankly, one of the reasons that Ukraine has this gas pipe is that it was hoped, again, by our friends the Germans, that this would create everybody having an interest in working together to let Ukraine be a bridge rather than a barrier is the slogan. Now, one thing we haven't talked much about on the call is that this does presume a competent Ukrainian government. And it's frankly the great tragedy of Ukraine that every European war for several hundred years now has entailed invading armies going back and forth across Ukraine. And the political culture and resources there were low to start with. So you have all the post-Soviet, post-communist problems you saw in other places, and you know, an intense degree of interdependence with Russia, just really, really high problematic levels of corruption, frankly, across the political spectrum, and now an intensely alienated and angry public, plus the part of the public that's intensely alienated and angry because it speaks Russian and thinks that everybody in Western Ukraine is a fascist. So, and you know, as you have all seen, the pro-Western Ukrainians do have their own extremists who are very unpleasant as well. So there is a need for massive, massive support to Kyiv in trying to put together a functional government, to root out the corruption of the past, to create a climate for investment so that, frankly, anyone other than Russia wants to invest there. And actually create an environment where Ukraine can, you know, Ukraine has now signed an association agreement with the EU. So to create an environment where that can actually turn into something meaningful. But that requires huge amounts of resources. And frankly, in recent years, the U.S. has really taken, I think, the theory that, you know, if we can't get the Europeans to pay for their own defense, at the very least they can pay for the needs of their neighbors. And so the U.S. has said, well, we'll really back off Ukraine and others in the region on the financial side and let the Europeans take the lead on that. It, you know, as we all know, it's something of a challenge to get resources for foreign assistance at this moment in time. But that, you know, any president, any administration, whatever you're doing, you know, Ukraine has to have a functional government. It has to have a functional army. We have to have functional civilian control. It has to have functional corruption and oversight, functional rule of law over financial markets. And those are all things where the U.S. and the EU both, but, you know, the U.S. because we've deliberately let the EU take the lead in recent years, could be doing quite a bit more.
Brian, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I would say in terms of whether, you know, Ukraine should be non-aligned, Ukraine may not want, you know, obviously to be in a sort of broader symbolic position that it's in, but I don't think it's something that we can really avoid. I mean, we've had a situation here where Putin has, you know, been annexed Crimea, fomenting civil war, shooting down a jetliner in Europe. And I think that there needs to Europe has a bad history, as we all know, of trying to be accommodating. And I think we're in that place again. And we know that sort of trying to accommodate Putin, I don't think, is going to have a very happy outcome for the continent. And maybe Europe is engaging in some amnesia right now. The urgent crowds out the important. But we're in this bad cycle now where the worse the Russian misconduct is, sort of the worse the aggression is, the less likely it's to be punished because Europe becomes afraid of him. So the more territory he seizes, the more innocents he kills, the more that the Europeans are afraid to provoke him. I even saw that one of the reasons given, you know, to not sort of go after Putin after the jetliner was down, because they were worried that it wouldn't that it wouldn't foster cooperation, you know, with the site, so that they could conduct an investigation. I mean, we're at a really horrible point. You couldn't even the Europeans couldn't even agree on an arms embargo to Russia after the plane was shot down. And I think that Ukraine at this point is much bigger than Ukraine. Putin has invaded Georgia. He's annexed Crimea. He's fomenting civil war inside Ukraine. And this is something which I think if we keep kind of playing footsie with Putin is not going to get better. It's going to get worse. And so we do have to worry about Ukraine and its sort of specific and concrete sort of circumstance. But I think this is a much bigger thing than the Ukraine.
Well, Brian, this is Christian. That actually brings up an interesting question because I think I was reading yesterday, and it may have been a piece by Fareed Zakaria that was talking about the rise of Putinism and that speeches that have been given by, I think it was the Ukrainian or the Hungarian prime minister laying out a vision sort of similar to what Putin has been talking about and sort of this new idea of illiberal democracy built on nationalism, state capitalism, media control, and that you're starting to see elements of that in other places like Turkey. So I guess what you're talking about is that the implications of this Ukraine situation on the rest of Europe could be a lot bigger, and that this they could sort of have a you know, a domino effect, I guess.
Right. I think that's true. I think Obama seems to be looking at this narrowly, just in terms of Ukraine. You saw this, whether it's something like in Syria or whether it's ISIS or whether it's the Ukraine, when there's some issue of whether we should be, you know, in none of the cases are we talking about boots on the ground, but in each case we are talking about, you know, making American assets available and doing all we can to try to shape events in a positive direction. And in each of those cases, it's always much short of what sort of my view is sort of required. In each of those cases, there's something much larger at play. And I just fear that we're missing that window. What you're talking about with the Fareed Zakaria piece, he was talking about how Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, had given a speech, and he was talking about this new political model of illiberal democracy. And it's an entirely different approach, and Putin seems to be the vanguard of this new approach. And this is the kind of direction that a lot of governments can go if there is a perceived or real vacuum where the West is largely saying, fine, you know, we're just not, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're kind of going to let everybody go where they want. I think it makes sort of Europe less free, less whole. Europe is the largest trading partner we have. We have a lot of interests in Europe being free and whole. We've had to fight two world wars there. We ought to be taking these things much more seriously than we are.
Yeah, I want to jump in on this illiberal democracy point because this is a trend that has been gathering steam, unfortunately, for maybe a decade or a little less now, where you have had Russia, Venezuela, the Gulf states, to a lesser extent, China, saying, look, we can have economic development and we can have increased citizen participation, and we'll actually get better results than you in the West with your messy processes. And frankly, the debacle around the Iraq war and then the debacle around the U.S. and the debt ceiling and the repeated embarrassments with our Congress have really fed into that narrative. I was in the United Arab Emirates during the first debt ceiling debate and had the embarrassment of sitting at dinner with the head of their sovereign investment corporation, who looked at us, this delegation of Americans, and as we squirmed, said, yes, you know, democracy is so unsuited for wise investment decisions. So unfortunately, you know, Putin's positioning within this movement and the U.S. missteps that really gave this narrative the opportunity to emerge have been going on for a while. And I think, you know, what the administration would say in response, and just the fact that it's a Democrat saying it doesn't make it less true, actually, is that first and foremost, the illiberal democracy movement will be defeated by liberal democracies thriving and doing well.
Exactly.
And, you know, where you have in Turkey the effort to really rein in an Islamic party that has gone from being, you know, 10 years ago, again, the great hope of a U.S. administration to being quite illiberal and problematic. There's nothing that U.S. military assistance or more active U.S. pressure can do to make that happen. Similarly, in Ukraine, there's a lot more that the U.S. can do and that I hope we do, but it's a little bit, you know, again, diluting our, you know, there is no amount of U.S. leadership that can compensate for Europe deciding that its interests lie in a different direction. And as Brian and I both said, I think and hope that will change, but we could just as easily be having this particular conversation with a Republican in office. So it's very tempting to add it to the list of things that, that the president has done wrong. And I absolutely agree that that Putin's status at the vanguard of illiberal democracy is an immense challenge for the U.S., but that is first and foremost not a military challenge. And it's actually not, and I enjoy saying this to a call of conservatives, in some ways it's not even a government challenge, right? It's two visions of how societies function. It's two visions of what the role of norms and rights are in how a society best works. And, you know, frankly, the way maybe the most important thing that the U.S. can do to regain the upper hand is to get our society and our political order to be functioning better and look, you know, as George Kennan called on us at the beginning of the Cold War, to actually look like we've got it figured out and we have a vision that we have confidence in.
Yeah, and I would just add to that to what Heather was saying. Since Putin is sort of looked to for a number of the people like Erdogan and Orban and others, and even some of the opposition parties in Europe who are looking to Putin, it's important to deny him a victory in Ukraine. He was able to take Georgia. He then waited a few years and is now, and, you know, well, in addition, what we haven't mentioned is what he's doing, you know, in Syria, what they're doing in Iran with the nuclear reactors, and then now what they're doing in Ukraine. He's winning, and, you know, people like winners. And when you've got a number of these governments in Europe and in Eurasia who are looking to Putin, it's important that we deny him a victory. It's just for the broader strategic cause. This is not something which he should be able to win.
Well, I think both of you had mentioned the 2008 crisis with Georgia. I mean, Heather, do you think that had we handled things differently in 2008, could we have deterred any of Putin's the boldness of his actions thus far? Or, you know, obviously it's easy to do Monday morning quarterbacking, but could we have plotted a different strategy then that this administration could have taken over and been dealt an easier hand?
Well, tempting as it is to say yes, it's all George W. Bush's fault. honestly, I'm afraid the answer is no, and the reason is this. Again, you can't change geography. We had even fewer strategic options in Georgia than we have in Ukraine. We had fewer ways to directly influence what was going on in Georgia. And Georgia is even farther removed from the concern of Europeans than Ukraine was. I mean, as painful as this is, it's been easier to get Europeans to respond to it, and Brian probably still has the scars from this, than it was over Georgia. So, geography is destiny, and there are limits. As painful as this is, there are limits to what anybody can do when a state decides to menace its immediate neighbors.
That's absolutely right. I was in the State Department when Russia invaded Georgia. You had a circumstance where Ukraine and Georgia are not a one-to-one, and it's very hard to draw any meaningful kind of parallels other than you have Russia as the key player in both sort of situations. But I just feel like they're dissimilar. You had Saakashvili, poking the bear a little bit, and Russia very happy to respond, and we certainly the folks in the State Department officials who were in that bureau who were working on it, I thought, did everything they could. Now Ukraine, I think, is an entirely different deal. This is a peaceful, democratic, sovereign country at peace, and then Putin comes in creating all sorts of pretenses to take action. It is good that Europe is taking this more seriously than Georgia. I feel like a lot of people in Europe thought that maybe Saakashvili, could have handled it differently to produce a different outcome.
All right. Well, this is Christian again. Let's do a last call for questions from our audience. If you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts, press star and then the pound key. Well, it looks like we've exhausted our questions. We still have a couple minutes left. Brian or Heather? We did have one. Somebody got in just at the last minute. Let's go to him right now.
Fred Young. Fred Young in Wisconsin. I wanted to know if there is hope that the corruption, which was so endemic in Ukraine under the previous administration, has got a chance of being reformed so that they can get on with government in a Western style.
I would say there's hope, but it's a long-term process. If you look at, the Russian economy post-Soviet Union, if you look at Belarus, if you look at Moldova, the prospects are poor. And particularly as long as you don't have a lot of avenues for, frankly, legitimate wealth creation. So everyone understands that that's a key problem, and certainly the young people who started all of this with their demonstrations were very focused on that. But I wouldn't want to hold out false hopes about how easy it's going to be or how there's some magic intervention that we or the EU could do that would make it better quickly.
Thank you.
Yeah, there is. I actually would. You asked kind of a timely question. The current issue of Foreign Affairs has an article about corruption being Ukraine's own worst enemy, and it sort of talks about why corruption is even more dangerous than Putin. None of what sort of I've mentioned is to sort of say that Ukraine doesn't have to get its own house in order, but a corrupt state should not be the predicate for another country invading it.
All right. Well, it looks like we had one other question jump on the line that we'll have time to get in.
Hi, it's Stanley Cook from the Northern Virginia area. A quick follow-up to the very recent discussion. I don't think either of the commentators has mentioned the new president. What's their size of him and how he may help or hinder?
You want to talk about Poroshenko?
I mean, I'll start by saying something not even so much about Poroshenko, but about, you know, I mean, you may have noticed that he had to dismiss parliament the other day because fistfights broke out. So, you know, even as I said, I think maybe a kind word for the Ukrainian political system is immature. And it's also worth noting that Poroshenko comes from a tycoon background, which on the one hand actually should position him well to position Ukraine between Russia and the West, should position him well to be able to talk to everybody. On the downside, it may mean that he's not necessarily as interested in as clean a break with some of the practices of the past as one might hope.
Brian, you have anything you want to add?
What he's going to have to be doing, Poroshenko is going to have to be, it's funny, we were talking about Georgia, but, you know, Georgia is a pretty decent case of how it did take on a lot of corruption. It adopted a zero-tolerance policy, you know, in government affairs, and there's an international ranking that talks about, you know, corruption, and Georgia was able to do a sea change, addressing its internal corruption issues. And I think that Poroshenko is going to have to do something very similar to what Georgia went through. It can be done, but it's going to have to be a complete restructuring of, you know, the political framework, legal framework, law enforcement framework, business systems, the size of the bureaucracy. All of it. It's a huge undertaking, but it can be done in that part of the world.
All right. Well, we're reaching the end of the call now. I guess I'll just give both panelists an opportunity. If you want to end with any concluding thoughts, don't feel compelled to. But anything that either of you would like to end with, or any final points you want to make, feel free to jump in.
No final points here other than thank you for hosting the call.
No problem. Heather, anything?
No, and likewise, and thank you for the great questions, actually, which were really substantive and added to the richness of the conversation.
Yeah, very good and thoughtful questions.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both Brian and Heather for joining us. Thank you to our audience. We always welcome your feedback by email to info@fedsoc.org. Also, be sure to check out our new and improved website. It's the same address, but it has received quite a new makeover. You can find this Teleform call as a podcast, as well as an archive of all of our other podcasts on the new website. And we encourage you to visit that often to see what else has been posted. So until next time, we're adjourned, and thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.